I've listed on the boards a number of topics that could be vehicles for us to go back to our congregations and could actually be used intact as titles for sessions in adult forums and youth groups and so forth. He's thinking the congregation actually is one of our more popular sessions in Lutheran Peace Fellowship. And I might say all of these are ones that we do in the Speakers Bureau in Lutheran Peace Fellowship. Hunger and militarism is a really big topic, again, in the last couple years. There's just a lot of possibilities for aiding hunger by trying to implement activities that reduce either U.S. support for militarism or U.S. support for positive things that would help counter militarism in the world. Christian nonviolence is, I think, a newly incredible topic for the congregation. I think there's and in fact, it's interesting, the peace statement that will almost certainly pass at the churchwide assembly at one point actually encourages congregations to study nonviolence. And throughout it, sort of walks the line between just work, tradition, and pacifism. And I think nonviolence is a good description of that middle terrain. It's a little more neutral of a term, and I think there are a lot of people that believe in the just war tradition that would affirm the tactics and vision of Martin Luther King and Dorothy Day and others. Conflict resolution for youth, conflict resolution for women, conflict resolution for men, conflict resolution for the congregation, conflict resolution for church committees. And there's a variety of appendages to that thing. Leadership training for peace and justice, unlearning violence, unlearning racism. We've really significantly expanded the Lutheran Peace Fellowship Speakers Bureau. By the end of the summer, we will have done 100 workshops this year. Around the country. We'll have probably 25 in just the three GMEs, for example, the 8 to 10 in each one of them. And at the churchwide assembly and the festival, and so forth. So that's a little bit of what I have in mind, and I'm prepared to talk a little bit more about Hiroshima Sunday, which I should actually have up there. The commemoration. I'll just abbreviate it. But also talk about ways the kinds of issues that we've spoken about this week and that are evident from these titles and Lutheran Peace Fellowship's resources can be of use in the congregational level, but also talk about your questions and issues and put them on the table and have, benefit from the resources here. And how do you deal with that, committee chairman of the church council who's like unbendable, or, how to institute peacemaking in conflicts between, leaders in the church? I've had so many pastors come up to me after, let's say, a more theoretical or spiritual discussion like Christian nonviolence, and they say, and I'm thinking, well, they're going to ask about a Bible text or something, and they'll say, I've got this conflict with the head of the men's club, and this is what's happened so far, and what do you think I could do? And so I'm open to that as well. Maybe we can start with the more educational level and move on to the other levels. So are there particular issues that you'd like us to focus on or start with or take a look at? Yeah.
Yeah, I'm the head of the church, I'm the president of the church council, and I have a real big problem with our pastor. I mean, he and I are just a loggerhead. No.
We'll set a session.
A special session for
$60
us,
right? An hour. Actually, that's kind of an old rate, isn't it?
Really? Yeah.
I loved Walt's comment the other day, he looked around and people had paid $100 to come to watch this play and they were getting a sermon. He said, we've got it all wrong. So, yeah.
What do you have resources for Christian nonviolence in particular? Do you have something to use with the resources?
Mm-hmm. We're putting together packets in like 7 different subjects, and They're all listed in the back of our newsletter. I have only like 8 left, and I'm happy to actually, there's probably enough that we could just hand them out. Leave it behind if you can't use it, or basically I give it to new members because we just mailed it, and it's like 75 cents to mail it now. But in the second last, the inside back cover, there's a list of resource packets, and the Christian Nonviolence one we're going to put out in our next issue of our newsletter, but we've got most of the elements already. The curriculum on violence and conflict resolution, there are a couple pieces. These three things right here are from that. And the article, the weapons connection on the back page. In September, we'll also have the ELCA peace statement packet. Fully expecting it will pass, but not wanting to get out on a limb until they do. And I can talk about, you know, some of the resources I found useful. I mean, these three books, for example, An Ethic for Enemies, that I referred to in the sermon last night, or the homily, John Deere or Jim Douglas's Orbis books that came out this year and last year. Walter Wink's Engaging the Powers, I think, is just a spectacular discourse on a whole lot of issues relating to it. John Howard Yoder and Thomas Merton are as reliable as they come on that. My sister, with her doctorate in theology, I defer to or ask advice of, is a very big fan of Stanley Hauerwas's approaches to ethics, and particularly the notion of character building as a kind of a centerpiece. So, a few of the resources there.
You know, I think sometimes I used to have a misconception that conflict resolution was an event, but it's an ongoing process. You think it's going to get done sometimes, but the personalities still remain there, and that you have to really understand that it's not something to be accomplished in the sense that it's finalized, that it's done, that it's something that continues on and on and on, and it's a way of dealing with things. It's an attitudinal issue rather than just an event that occurs.
That's very good. And what I like to emphasize, too, is there are a lot of people, there's something in the Lutheran tradition, and I know it having grown up in a, you know, with a very intense childhood experience of Lutheranism, very active church light, it was the centerpiece of my community experience, that there's something in our tradition that has made it difficult to make the connection between even the thinking and attitudes and the actions. And I put quite a bit of emphasis on skill building as well. But you're right. I mean, there are just new levels of spirituality and consciousness. Walter Wink tells what he reports as an embarrassing experience of getting mugged and getting really angry and stuff like that. And in another place, talks about he and his wife were once mugged, and the roles, the traditional gender roles, were switched. He wanted to hand over the wallet, and she was like defending him, you know. But reporting how in the crunch, haven't we all had the experience of in a conflict? You know, we think afterwards, what kind of a Christian am I? What did I just do? You know, it just came right out of my mouth. You know, where did that come from? It's wonderful to read the personal stories of Martin Luther King or Gandhi or Dorothy Day or other, you know, well-known peacemakers, and without exception they're on their knees saying, I'm the worst of sinners, you know, I have the greatest struggle, you know, I've struggled all my life with X and I'm still wrestling with it, you know, and yet maybe they're also models of what can happen if you do engage that task, if you have a discipline of nonviolence. I mean, a personal discipline. We have really a lot to learn, I think, from Catholic traditions that, you know, that have spiritual exercises. It's really not something that is very Lutheran, and I think we really miss it. I can't quite figure out why, you know, in the congregation I grew up in, there were communities of people, the women who did the quilting and several other committees who actually ended up improvising those sorts of support networks for Christian growth. But by and large, and I think maybe more for men than women, we're so socialized to be atomized and to not, use our closest relationships even as places to put out all but like very specific conflicts, but to do this kind of longer term Christian growth, which is what I heard you saying, is something that is needs to be replanted in the beds of our being and allowed to flower.
But you see that also with child rearing too. Okay, you can't understand child abuse until you've had children, because the way they capture you and you get engaged in that kind of process, that's very difficult to break unless you begin. And you can imagine people who have some control, and then you find people who are single parents, and then you see that occur with the, and you can understand some of the dynamics that have occurred. And it's very important to have that process available to people and to practice that.
Right. I want to share an anecdote about the notion of learning on the one hand and thinking and talking and spirituality and action on the other. I was a part of a group that was working in the churches on trying to change some of the really egregious problems in healthcare in New York City in the mid-70s. And we had ourselves studied a lot of different materials from the American Hospital Association and the AMA and Health PAC and all the different points of view, read every article that came out in the New York Times and Wall Street Journal and so forth. So we set up these study groups that sort of modeled what we had gone through on a little more organized basis. And at the end, talked about then moving forward into activities. And it was like a thud. I mean, just nothing happened for week after week after week. We would just talk about doing something. And we realized that by having set up our structure that was mainly thinking and talking, the people that were burning to act and for whom thinking was a little lesser a priority dropped out or whatever. And by having only people that thought, there wasn't the critical mass to move anywhere. And the lesson was, we did more things with that group of people. We just really started from scratch. And from the very first session, had activities that the group engaged in. And we would, every second or third session, it would be focused almost entirely on some activity that they would go back and do surveys, polls in their congregations and come back, or activity kinds of things. And thus retained a mix of people for whom their preference was in one direction or the other. And it's, I think, a really important lesson for activities in the congregation to not just have discussion as the main thing, particularly when you have a series of activities on a given subject, and expect it to ever get more than discussion. Realistically, you may be better at it than I was or we were, but and in fact, I mean, congregations develop a tone. There are pastors who I think sincerely say, I've tried to involve people in, Covenant of Letters and Bread for the World or other kinds of activities, and it just doesn't go anywhere. Well, what is the tone that was set in that congregation over the last years that had what people who circulate through our congregations, and we all see them every Sunday, sort of looking, is this a place for me? And what kind of tone are we putting out to people? And that tone is changeable. That tone is something that you can advertise more broadly in the community and recruit back people that have other kinds of interests and styles and develop the kind of mix of people that will make a congregation the kind of three-dimensional, full flowering of the Spirit that I think is essential. And you know, there are a lot of windows on that. I'll share the one that I've shared a couple times before. I mean, my reading of, you know, what would it have been like to have been a Lutheran in the 1930s in Germany? The lesson that just is overwhelming to me and formed the article, Humbling Empowering, which is my response to the 30s in Germany, is to say, what I would have wanted to have done would not only have been challenging Christians in my awareness, in my circle, in my community, to think about the gospel, to look at the gospel in its full, flavor, but also to have been building, you know, organizational structure that can act. I would have been embarrassed, humiliated, and worse, shamed, had I come to 1937 or 38 when it became you know, very, very difficult to do anything anymore, and to feel that I had really wasted the early 30s by having done all of the various pastoral duties except helping Christians understand the gospel in their action, in organizational structures. I mean, very practically, organizational structures, committees, you know, social justice committees, and etc., within the church that act. And I think that Lutherans would be in a very sad shape if we were to do an assessment of where we stand on that subject right now. Now, I make clear that I don't think that the United States in the 90s is a direct parallel to Germany in the 30s. There are, however, some disconcerting parallels that you can't help but notice. The rise of the fundamentalist right, and in particular the violent militarized right. The really quite dramatic expressions of hostility toward the other, you know, immigrants, legal immigrants being denied social services in the largest state in the Union is a disturbing parallel to what was going on there, to targeting the poor and the helpless, you know, questioning whether social services ought to be given to the most vulnerable in society was precisely where Germany was in 1933. The first steps. But leave those parallels aside. Look then further, more deeply. Suppose it's true that I'm right and not my friends who say, oh, it's fascism rearing its head in the United States. Suppose I'm right about that. It is still true that in the same way that Germany became a kind of an embodiment of the principalities and powers, you know, in a very ugly way, While the United States may have many more positive features and a democratic structure that at least has some possibilities, you know, for balancing that out or for preventing some of those excesses, I think the truth is that if a clear analysis of U.S. activity around the world in particular, and in some issues like gun violence, you know, among our youth, Walter Wink's, really detailed discussion about that notion. I mean, it is precisely that Ephesians, you know, notion of the principalities and powers that he sees the United States being very much a vehicle for, if you will. I'm not doing any justice at all to that concept, and I'll refer you simply to that. But there's a way that simply because the United States is the world's remaining superpower, that we have a special responsibility, I believe, to not simply preach the truth, engender spirituality that is appropriate to these times, but to also have that connected intimately with leadership in action, leadership in embodying, in carrying out, so that the support of the Christian community is not just for the spirituality, and people are left to go home and do the action, but that the community can provide that kind of support, you know, for people to act. And of course, the natural, you know, question or caution that raises in our minds is, you know, well, does that mean the church then, as church, becomes a vehicle for, let's say, supporting a Democrat or a Republican candidate? No. And there's a lot of qualification, and particularly at the beginning, while we're experimenting with some of this stuff, you know, I think there should be a lot of qualification. We're going to try this out. We're going to see how it works. But it is transparent to me that there's something fundamentally wrong, fundamentally un-Christ-like about ending a sermon with, and now it behooves all of us to search our heart, to find where we need to go with this, and to go home and act as Christians, and to make that an atomistic experience rather than a corporate one, a community one, one where we're upbuilding one another in the Spirit. Does that make sense? I mean, do you feel as strongly that this is an issue in your congregation as I feel in either in my experience in Lutheran congregations?
Yeah. Well, isn't an uprising of the violence that we've had over the last 30 to 40 years because we've sort of lost the structure, not only from within our own society, but also within the church? Uh-huh. I mean, services that you used to go to in the 50s and early 60s, and I mean real early 60s, I mean everything was structured. You knew, you know, how things were going to be, and now everything is become so open and where there is no structure.
Right.
And that, when there is no structure, it's just like raising children.
Right.
If children are not given any structured environment, they tend to be wilder, you know. And the more structured right. environment that they have, the more peaceful that they seem to grow up.
I lived in the Lower East Side in New York for many years and worked by coincidence for several years in the highest crime precinct in New York City. And had 4 years in the poorer areas of Oakland as well. And both have personally seen that violence in like dozens of occasions. In fact, let me just share one that illustrates that. The block I lived on was characterized by slumlords. I mean, it was one of the best things that happened was the conversation that developed among people who would be standing out in front of their buildings or sitting on the stoops, and I would sort of make the rounds as the kind of block social worker, unpaid and unnamed, to just talk with people and to find out what was going on, and because I knew a couple of the cops that were around regularly. I mean, I would be a kind of a conduit for people that just had no connection with any of the social service structures or police or anything, you know. And, you know, sort of a self-appointed, you know, like doing the best you can in the neighborhood sort of thing. And my role as a group worker, a social worker, a teacher, you know, kind of got me into that naturally. The building next door to mine, through a variety of horrible things, ended up the landlord sort of gradually squeezing people out, and he had fixed it up a little bit and was going to charge higher rents. And it had been rent controlled, and he was getting out from under that burden. And but he was just too incompetent to sort of get it together, and it just sat there empty. And before long, the kids broke in through the door on the roof. You could get up on the roof and climb down into any building. I mean, it was one of the design flaws from the 30s when things were a lot safer. That particular building, right through the wall where my head lay when I slept, was that building. And where kids broke in and were living there. And I would hear cries that seemed like girls and very young. And finally, I overcame my reluctance and my inability to get in through any of the front door kind of directions, and finally just got my flashlight, dressed, looking as sort of tough as I could, or at least strong. You know, I didn't want to be intimidating or look like a thug, but I also didn't want to look weak. And climbed down into the dark, and, you know, no lights. All the lights were turned off. stairway down to where it was going on. And in fact, there was some really unfortunate abuse of a girl that was going on. Maybe a dozen kids living there. The floor completely littered everywhere with Colt 45 bottles that apparently they could sneak out in their clothes, and glue tubes. I ended up spiriting the girl away to the girls' club half a mile north from where I live. And she just disappeared, you know, from them anyway. And just getting into conversation with everybody else. And the stories were just, as soon as they realized that I wasn't going to arrest them or do anything bad to them or whatever, I was listening more than talking, which is kind of new to their experience. Every one of them would, I think every single one of them, or virtually every one of them, told me their story over the next couple of weeks. And mother, kid's mother was in jail. The father hadn't seen since he was a kid, and he was living with his uncle, and his uncle beat him. So he would go home to change clothes once a week or so. And just one story after another of kids that had fallen through the cracks in the society. And I think exactly what you're saying. I mean, I don't think all was healthy with what I grew up with in the 50s and, you know, late 40s, on the one hand. But it was, at its worst, better than a lot of what replaced it, you know. People fell through the cracks back then, too, but not on this scale. And not, you know, whole neighborhoods of just dismal, you know, depressing levels of unemployment and sickness and drugs and all the rest. And it's true that, I mean, a whole lot of structures have crumbled. And, you know, the flight to the suburbs has created different kinds of ghettos that have their own problems. I mean, because they are designed to separate themselves from, you know, from these problems. I mean, I'm oversimplifying, but I mean, that's not entirely untrue. You know, there's a kind of a lack of three-dimensionality about that too, and in fact, those people are missed, if for no other reason than that by brushing with more of the elements than just getting, you know, fear of being attacked when you get off the, you know, the wrong turn on the freeway and get into the wrong neighborhood, a la Grand Canyon, the movie, if you've ever seen it, really wonderful movie, I should say. I'm sorry, I kind of veered off into that. I'm happy to talk more about maybe what are some of the sources of it, but I'm equally eager to talk about some of the ways that we can address these problems. And
one of the problems, I've just been made supporter of our church and society, supported our church, which has had a tradition of kind of being the burr under the saddle in our congregation.
Uh-huh.
And we became that way by deciding about 10 years ago that some of us had gone to Central America and come back and ran into the situation, which wasn't, you know, which is different than Germany in the 1930s, but what you run into is a strong sense of nationalism in this country. And if you get into a situation where you begin to criticize the U.S. foreign policy,
right,
it doesn't go down very well in congregations.
I mean, right.
I can anticipate already,
most within congregations
in August, which we'll intend to do. It's difficult to do that when you've got people in the congregation that serve the Guadalcanal.
Right.
And you've got to be sensitive to that.
Right.
But one of the things, one of the mechanisms that we found, and I think that videos is a way to begin discussion, but you're right, discussion gets to be cheap and is gone in 10 minutes most of the time. But what we found is that our board shifted the money that we had as part of our budget. We shifted it from charity to justice issues. And so we began to use the money that we had allotted to us for our board's actions from, you know, just a practical way of getting at this, from giving it, you know, we still supported the Native Gospel Mission and the soup kitchen and things like that. But we also shifted it into things that weren't clearly Lutheran, and were more things like calc and things, some Catholic, point to Catholic schools in town, a women's transitional housing place where the connection between the church and the secular area was a little bit greater. And the other thing we started to do was send money to things like the Lutheran Church in El Salvador. And if people are congregation would say, what in the world is a Lutheran Church in El Salvador? Do you need money for it? And you can allow that then as a way to say, listen, there's Lutherans in El Salvador or being oppressed by the government, we're supporting $1 million a day. And then we got connected with Namibia. What happened in Namibia? A lot of people are running away and we're calling communists and not Lutherans. And educate our congregation. And you have to go through that for a few years. People start to feel that maybe everything I'm working with says about some types of people here isn't correct. Allotting money to it gets the church council's attention. And they start to ask me, why are you doing it? And it gives you a vehicle.
Those are very, very good suggestions. And in fact, I have made it a kind of a personal policy to not verbally draw the conclusion that the U.S. government is supporting bad things, but to talk about the issue, to present the issue, maybe have some reprints that would make those connections, but leave people to decide that at their own speed and on their own terms. Most justice issues, it's possible to not fall into, what I think is a superficial or a kind of a shortcut attempt to try to get people to look at an issue, but rather, present the facts of the issue, and focusing just on the most concrete experiential kinds of things, and let people themselves ask or have it as a later discussion, what is the U.S. government policy in that area, and move to those as a second thing. And I think that the op-ed page is not necessarily the best kind of step-by-step approach to something.
One of the privileges my wife and I had was to be in Berlin, Leipzig, and Wittenberg, Germany, on VE Day.
Oh, wow.
And I'm intrigued with what you have done for, Hiroshima, possible prayers that would be another way to go that would be safer in most congregations. One of the things that impressed us was we did not see a church that day, and we hop around between churches, that's how we tour, that didn't have at least one service on VE Day. And came back and looked at all of the papers that had accumulated and all of the articles about how inappropriate it was for Soviet Union, Germany, Japan, and their attitude toward the end of the Second World War. I've been trying to find one Lutheran church anywhere that had a service on VE Day here, but they had them there. I would really hope that we can make one more effort in this unusual year in Hiroshima. BJ ended the Second World War, ended Dietrich Bonhoeffer's life, and August certainly would be a time to do that, or some other time this year.
In terms of Bonhoeffer, I've left out the sheets that I used in the talk that I gave a week ago, Barman to Bonhoeffer, and I'm happy to share some other material on that if you're interested. I think any time this year it would be appropriate to just leave aside that it was April 9th that he died, and just say, before we end 1995, we decided this mid-November Sunday to have our adult forum on Dietrich Bonhoeffer or on the Confessing Church in Germany and share the stories. There's a book, regrettably expensive, over in the library. A couple of people that came to my session bought it because I went ahead and I told the guy that runs the bookstore, John, I said, come on, these aren't moving. How about not 20% off like you have some of these other books? And he said, okay. So any of you that would like to take home a truly spectacular book, The Protestant Protest Against Hitler, The Soul of the People is the title, by Victoria Barnett, just came out last year or the year before. It's a $30 book, but $24 for you. Do it. It has these amazing stories of the congregation's choir quadrupling in size because they went and sang outside the Gestapo prison that held their pastor. And they went through the ringer, the people that got arrested, but the pastor got released. Or the synodical meeting that was broken up by the Gestapo, and the folks reconvened at someone's house and decided, we need to protest this. And to make a long story short, 2 days later, 30,000 German Lutheran and Reformed and United Christians filled the entire town square and the hall they were going to meet in and every other hall around that could be wired into the sound system to tell the Germans they didn't think this was such a hot idea. The Gestapo ought to stay out of the church. And I mean, those stories, I think, can help people see the color and the amazing things. I mean, the sad thing is how many, you know, horrible things happened without a peep. But there wasn't a single issue in Germany that didn't have some heroic stories that ought to be shared, and that can be models of what we need to do when those same sorts of things happen, you know, on maybe a lesser extent here. And as well, the caution that I shared from An Ethic for Enemies, you know, that not only does our past insert itself into your present and shape your future, you know, that, but also if our generation was capable of doing this, so, you know, so can yours. First page of the section on Hiroshima in here. So I totally agree. And for Hiroshima, my strategy would be, I mean, I have a really great church. They've already asked me to be a part of the Hiroshima planning. But if I was in a more, you know, mixed or conservative church, I would talk to every veteran, or particularly the more open-minded veterans, and ask them to help me do it. And to say, I'm committed to this not being taking sides on Hiroshima. I didn't serve in a camp, or I didn't serve in the military, you know. I want to honor that service at the same time that I acknowledge that the veterans that I know more than anyone else know the horrors of war and how we ought to not get into it. I mean, when I was in graduate school, I did a mini study that concluded that it was a paper. It concluded that the majority of times the United States has gone to war, the military leaders were a restraining force, and it was political leaders that had never served in the military that wanted to use this power that they had, you know, internationally in some fashion. I mean, it's just a fact. It was a general who said war is hell. And I mean, there's common ground there that, so, you know, so long as we're careful that we don't, like, take sides on, you know. And I guess my rule of thumb is don't take sides on the controversial issues unless there's space for it to be really discussed in an open and a caring and a, you know, helpful way for everybody. Everybody ought to have a chance. I mean, that's democracy, to my idea. That's fairness. That's thinking about the long term and not just trying to take some shortcut to try to get people to believe what you believe. That's the wrong way and the wrong motivation for getting involved in social justice in the congregation. The right way is to help each person in their own conscience decide how they are going to act and how they can express the gospel in their life and not just simply in the words, and to support and upbuild their spirituality.
One quick comment and a question.
Yeah.
Something I've found over the years, that the greater the distance from the concern, the greater that concern is within the parish.
Uh-huh.
You alluded to the legal immigration status in the largest state. Is this problem
California.
You're talking about?
California.
Yeah.
Right.
I'm from California.
Yeah.
This is what you're alluding to.
Yes.
Yeah. Which I thought the church did a terrible job, or whoever tried to explain it. And we're notorious for writing issues in the state to vote on, that when you vote for something, you're voting against it.
Well, but you didn't see the person that wrote that wanted it to pass, you know. So, I mean, you know, I think one of the best things we could do is to help people ask the question, who's behind this?
But, like, but it wasn't a legal immigrant status. It was an illegal immigrant status. And the question was not service, but who's going to pay for it? And this was Pete Wilson's issue that I interpreted.
Yeah.
Was fine, it exists, but somebody's got to bail us out. We can't take the state into debt. At $430 per citizen per year to provide a service on our own. And that was the outcry that kept getting muffled constantly.
True.
Again, that I never heard the church make a stand, but the thing from Wilson, I heard a summary the other day about how he may be a great presidential candidate for the negative effects of 187 throughout society,
right,
as opposed to the fact of saying we can't keep affording $430 per person per year to give service to people. Right. Somebody's got to bail us out.
You on the ground need to think about what, you know, just like you're saying, to help people interpret and weigh and look at and examine and figure out a way that it's not going to be simply bailing out of some need and hope that someone takes it over, but actively. I mean, you could have gotten a lot of people that opposed the proposal on board if there was a strategy to deal with the need that existed. You know,
I wasn't opposed to it. I think someone needs to take record.
Yeah.
Because last week the county came out and said, we're closing USC hospital. We can't afford that anymore. And this is the legal immigrant situation.
Yeah.
We can no longer as a society keep funding this service on our own.
Right.
The county is going broke.
We have a terrible, I worked in healthcare for 15 years, including health policy, all the way up to being a consultant to a White House conference. It's a tragedy what's happened, and you know it's human greed versus human need.
What I can understand is my wife is a foreign national, and when we got married, we had to jump through so many hoops to prove that when she came to the United States, she would not go on welfare. Yet we allow immigrants to come into this country who are greeted at the border with a book of food stamps, and that I find repulsive.
That's ridiculous. Thank you.
It's ridiculous. You go to Canada today, right up here in Vancouver, and with the immigrants coming out of Hong Kong, each one of them is required to supply, having a bank in Canada, $1 million before they're allowed to come across the border.
The Immigration and Naturalization Service has a reputation of being one of the agencies in government that is most in need, if not the very top one, in need of just a total overhaul. I mean, the friends of mine that have worked on immigration cases just say it's just unbelievable on, you know, the type of personnel, the kinds of regulations they work under. I mean, there's some really serious problems in that area.
I deal with these people on a daily basis, the Immigration and Customs Services.
Uh-huh.
And I agree with you. They need supervision from the top down.
Yeah. And it's unbelievably restrictive in some ways. You know, I mean, going back to the St. Louis, I mean, that a boatload of Jews that got turned back, ultimately back to certain death. I mean, you know, ought to stand as a reminder that there's a problem on that end of the scale, mm-hmm. as well as maybe, you know. I thought I saw a hand over here.
Well, I wanted to go back to one of your comments also about the, it wasn't the Germans in Germany, it was the Nazis. My grandmother wore a sign around her neck in Chicago that said, "I am a German, not a Nazi," as she walked in the streets.
Right.
Because she spoke with a very heavy German accent.
One of the very useful statistics in that are on that fact sheet on the first page is how many Nazi party members there were when Hitler came to power in January, mm-hmm. and then 3 months later. And it was less than, I believe it was less than 1% of the population were members of the party. Let's see, Nazi Party membership was 849,000 in January 1993, and their population of the country, I think, was under 60 million. So, that's really tiny. I mean, Hitler stole the chancellorship.
He did.
I mean, it was craft. He was never elected to it. And in fact, when you read the details of it, Himmler and a couple of other of his cronies were across the street in a hotel with binoculars when Hitler came out of the room with Hindenburg, the head of government, trying to read the expression on Hitler's face whether he'd succeeded in becoming chancellor. And he cut this deal with this guy that was his total political opposite, virtually, that Hitler would be chancellor and this other fellow who was more powerful in some ways, but had a whole nother block of votes, would get the majority of cabinet seats. And it looked like a pretty good deal at the time, but Hitler knew he could totally outwit, and it didn't take him 3 months before he had ousted them and consolidated his power. But I mean, Nazi Party membership and votes in the elections had actually declined the previous year, and they saw the writing on the wall. If they didn't grasp the ring now, they were going to be a perpetual, you know, tiny minority party, and they stole what they weren't able to get by vote. Amazing story. And then to move with the ruthlessness that he did. I mean, the way he practiced divide and conquer kinds of tactics with the church, you know.
His best way for understanding that.
You know, and that won't happen exactly. But there's some lessons about being manipulated by political authorities that I'd sure like some of the fundamentalist Christians to do for their political counterparts. I think there's some severe manipulation going on there. You know, people saying, you know, we can help you get members, and you can help us in some other ways. And so, peacemaking in the congregation. Can we take one last dip at ways that you found effective in your congregation, or questions about how to go back, let's say, with the Hiroshima materials? There's 3 pages of information in here that I think are very useful, including a really wonderful interview with a leader in the Japan Evangelical Lutheran Church in one of their seminaries. Some additional quotations that can be useful to give some color and life to your activities. Let's see if there's any other thoughts. Hunger and militarism, it's a really stunning chart. It takes you about 5 minutes to figure out what it means, but all of these blocks represent $1 billion of military spending in the world today. United States accounts for about a quarter of that, but many third world countries, if we could get them to reduce their military spending over 2 or 3 years by 20%, you could totally pay for population control, which is a lot of people are seeing as the most important thing, or stabilizing or preventing acid rain, providing health care, provide clean water. You know, just a tiny reduction in that military spending, and yet U.S. policy is being driven by Ron Brown in the Commerce Department, not the State Department or the Defense Department, and we're playing that role of being, you know, this tremendous supplier of arms to the world. I mean, level of arms sales in the world is 2 or 3 times what it was during the height of the Cold War, after you adjust it for inflation. I mean, it's a horrendous situation. And, you know, congressman after congressman, I visit a lot of them already, you know, around the country. When I visit, you know, when I'm out speaking to her, they'll often go along on those visits. And they'll say, well, you know, it's jobs in our district. And then we come back and say, oh, no, it isn't. It may be a job just in one moment, but if you look across the board, our economy is losing jobs because of that. We're subsidizing it. And let me ask you, you know, do you want 500 or 200 jobs in your district because of a military contract, or do you want thousands of jobs if we put that same, you know, federal support for arms sales into something where there's real money to be made, not the tens, you know, of billions of dollars in military sales. You know, it's been in the $40 to $60 billion range the last few years. You know, real money. We're talking hundreds of billions of dollars. And then now, you know, the exercise of, we could brainstorm, a group of your, you know, constituents could brainstorm in 5 minutes, high-definition television, fiber optics, you know, environmentally sustainable technologies, seeds and grains and agricultural supplies. There's where some really big money is to be made in the world, you know, in the next decade. Military sales is inevitably going to decline. Why should we be, as a country, so careless, so thoughtless, so stupid as to support military buildups around the world when the money that we're just using to subsidize that could do so much for our economy as well as for the world's, you know, stability, to reduce the need for our, us to have high levels of military spending. You know, the military, the Pentagon's list of countries that we have to be afraid of, more than half of them are ones that we're supplying with advanced weaponry. Ask the troops themselves. I mean, this isn't just liberal talk. Ask the troops themselves. What are the things they would most not like to have happen when they go overseas? And on all of their lists, I don't want to face our weapons. I don't want to face M1 tanks that are being manufactured in Egypt and Turkey right now, or F-16 fighter planes that are being manufactured in 16 different countries now. And we're not just selling the weapons. We're selling the technology. We're selling the patents. We're selling the plants to build them. Another reason why it's not going to be U.S. workers that are going to benefit. So we're doubly being hurt. We're being hurt economically by those deals, but we're also being hurt militarily in the future. Nobody can tell you for certain. Question again, I've asked State Department and Pentagon officials at the middle and high levels. Nobody can tell you who's going to be in charge in the country of Kuwait in 5 years, or South Korea, or, you know, Pakistan or Taiwan or Indonesia or Turkey or any of these other countries that are big, big clients. Iran was one of our top weapons recipient in the 70s. Who would tell us that, you know, Khomeini is an improvement over what we had there? I mean, again, you know, notice I'm not using liberal arguments. I mean, there are moral issues here, but there are practical, self-interested kinds of things, you know, democratic kinds of things that are our principal appeal, our major appeal.
What worked and didn't work? 20 years ago, LCA had a program, Social Justice and Change, basically headed by Lee Wesley. We got trained, we got charged up,
yeah.
We did presentations. Our own council wouldn't partake in it.
Right.
After we got through the first presentation, we realized, one, intellectually, no way, no contact. Emotionally, yes, we broke some ground. We met the Zolba program and then great material, phenomenal causes. Intellectually, it didn't work. You could not attack the problem on an intellectual basis. Again, some type of emotion. We were able to identify people on a gut level with some material. It was totally misdirected.
I mean, I've probably given 60 talks since I, well, more than that, since I, you know, came on the staff of Lutheran Peace Fellowship. And we're working out a lot of kinks. I mean, there are a lot of things that I haven't figured out. But I feel on a gospel level, on an emotional level, on an intellectual level, we're roughly on the right track. I think we've had very strong positive feedback on all three levels on the programs that we're working on. I mean, hunger and militarism, I've been in Bread for the World from the beginning by a coincidence of geography. I was the first member of Bread for the World. I mean, there's something really powerful about that issue. Similarly, I mean, just the Christian nonviolence. I'll be doing, I've only done 3 or 4, maybe 5 talks on that so far, and I'll be doing about 8 more this summer. And I hope by the end of that I've got, you know, a better handle on that. But I mean, the session that I did here, I thought, you know, I got some positive feedback. But I need this kind of situation, and perhaps especially what you're going to tell me, you know, at lunch and sort of informally afterwards to fine tune it. But and the other thing is, I mean, I've been involved in efforts to provide leadership to grassroots chapters of both secular and religious groups over the years. And Lutheran Peace Fellowship has the most extraordinary talent base of people at Higgins Road, in the synodical level, in various positions, but especially pastors and leaders on the congregational level of any group I have ever seen. Or been personally involved. I mean, the capabilities are there. I mean, 5 years from now, we may be talking about we've run up against some barriers, or, you know, the congregations that were more accessible to what we were doing are now on board, but, you know, what's the next step? And we'll have some new challenges. But for right now, I mean, the opportunities and the possibilities are really almost limitless, or feel like it. It's just amazing what we can do. You know, just think, if 1% of Lutherans are ready to join with us to do these kinds of activities, that would be 50,000 people. You know, the resources and the talent and the skill and the the quality of materials that you could put out with a group that had even half that many members, you know, I suppose because of the, you know, the difficulties of building an organization, 30,000, you know, become members and are active and working and so forth. And both the board and the structure of LPF is such that it, you know, that it really is a grassroots kind of operation. You know, people have a lot of opportunity. I mean, it's not a real hierarchical kind of thing where there's a single idea of where we're going to go and everybody falls in line. It really comes from the people that are doing the work. And
I think that's one approach. I think this gentleman has a real point where Lutherans have been very good at head knowledge, but we haven't been so good at sensing the heart, sensing the fear that I think was in the way of the program that was mentioned in the former LCA. And we came in with head knowledge, kind of like a bulldozer, and sometimes weren't as careful to listen to what was the fear. And there's a lot of fear out there, especially if people find economic or whatever kind of difficulties that get in the way. I think we've done that, frankly, many times very badly. I think we can do better now. I think perhaps we realize that the whole person somehow is involved rather than just coming in with an argument that is superior to someone else's.
Right. I agree. And I mean, I feel like I'm constantly kind of kicking myself or learning from those kinds of bumps in the road, you know. But I think we do have a qualitatively different sense of how to do that that's much less rigid and much more listening, you know, to where people are at.